Jim Chambers, real too.
Well, the other method of killing them was by what they call a chin jab, and that is where you cupped your hand and put one hand behind the opponent's back, and with the cupped hand you would thrust it upwards under the chin, and at the same time bringing up your knee into the crutch, and that was very disabling. So it invariably it broke their neck.
So was that fatal?
Usually, yeah. Yeah. We didn't actually kill anybody. But yes, it would be quite horrendous, really, to carry it out. The other thing was to jab your fingers in their eyes or up the nostrils. Bringing the sole of the shoe down the front of the shin and stamping on the instep. What else was there? Must have been other things, I'm sure, but they taught you how to chop, you know, to break up with the side of the hand to inflict injury.
Where would that be directed?
Well, usually they said direct it at the bridge of the nose or the neck.
Did anybody object to all this?
No. Well, no, we quite thoroughly enjoyed it.
Sorry, you were just about to tell me about Henley.
Oh, Henley, yes. That was, we went to Henley-on-Thames. There was one place there that was called Countess Gardens, where we did intensive Morse code to bring up the speed of sending and receiving. I think we were up to 20 plus words per minute time we finished there, and that was all we did at Henley, really, was Morse code.
Were you able to cope with what was demanded of you?
Oh yeah, I think we were all very fit and all wanted to do the job. It was a much better environment for everybody, really, getting away from the army proper.
But by now you must have realised that you were going to into occupied enemy territory.
Yes, but I think that things were such that once, if you've been involved with the army as it was then, I don't know what it's like today, but as it was then, it was absolutely horrendous. I mean, there's so much idiocy, really, in there, that it was just a pleasure to get away from it. I was certainly afraid of, when I was in the 23rd Hussars, of sort of confronting the Atlantic Wall in a tank with the leadership that we had. Because we did have a visit by an ex-Western Desert officer, supposed to be on a morale-boosting exercise for the troops, and he appeared with one arm. He'd lost an arm in the desert. And he also had on display an 88 armour-piercing shell, and alongside that, the current weaponry that we were using at the time was the 2-pounder gun on the Crusader. And I was amazed, really, when he said that the 2-pounder was absolutely useless against German armour. He said because the German armour could stand off sort of 5,000 metres, and if they didn't get you with the first one, the third one definitely. And he said the effective range of the 2-pounder was about 200 metres, so you didn't stand a great deal of chance. So it didn't impress me. It didn't boost my morale one little bit.
But you also felt a lack of confidence in the leadership in the cavalry?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, there was one particular instance when we were alerted that we were to take part in the North Africa campaign. and the tanks were to got ready for embarkation. But prior to that, we should have a visit from the King, King George VI, and the 11th Armoured Division was to be on parade, the whole division. And each tank, well, I can only speak for the 23rd Hussars, but each tank crew was ordered to draw, which in those days was a 4-gallon can of petrol for the petrol store, and wash out the inside of the tank with petrol. This is prior to the inspection. And then come the day, the driver was allowed to get in the tank, and he had to wear his gym shoes, plimsolls. And the other crew, I was a crew member, got in the tank. I was also wearing plimsolls. We weren't allowed to wear the boots. They were to be carried separately. Anyway, the whole division paraded on this huge area, and all the tanks were lined up, and the petrol cans that had been emptied were now filled, had now been filled up with water and put on a 3-tonner and taken to the site. And the crews then drew these cans of water and took them down to the tanks and washed off the tank tracks of the mud. And once that was done, we were allowed to put our boots back on and stand in front of the tank. And then His Majesty arrived, late as usual, and he was driven in a white scout car to one tank that had been sighted in the middle of the parade, and climbed up some steps, peeked into the turret, came down the steps, got into his white scout car and went. And that was the sum total of the King's Parade.
Where was that?
That was in Norfolk. Norfolk somewhere. Can't recall the actual site. And after that, the North Africa was cancelled. That was cancelled for the 11th Armoured, and that's when we went up to Yorkshire and changed over to Sherman tanks. And we did a lot of training in the Sherman. But the frightening thing about the Sherman was it was such a tall tank compared to a Crusader. And also the petrol tanks were sighted on either side of the tank. And I think there was something like 200 gallons of petrol. But the most frightening aspect was, of course, that the side of the tank was flat. And reading reports after the wars, but they called them Ronsons or Tommy Cookers, I think. So I wasn't really impressed with the Army Corps.
Now, if we can go back to Henley on Thames, any incidents that happened to you there?
No, not really. It was just a question of very, very intensive training. I can't recall the actual hours of training, but it was very intensive, and that's what we did day after day. And we did little schemes where we went out to, where was that, another place in the Henley called Forley Court, where they had little huts, and we would go in the huts, and then we would send and receive messages from other operators there, and that would give us an idea of, you know, actual field operations.
By now, were you getting to know the other people who were training with you?
Oh, yes, indeed, yeah. Yes, I found them all okay and very keen.
Who were the people you were getting to know by this time?
What, their actual names? Oh, well, it was Ron Brady, he was one, Fred Bailey, Tom Henney, Norman Smith, and quite a few of the others, yeah.
And after Henley?
After Henley, I think after Henley we went to Dunbar. I can't think of the actual house in Dunbar, but we were up there. I know it was very cold, so that would be in the winter month. And there we also did intensive training and with the radios, and they had an idea that they would take us out in trucks and drop off two people, and then we would operate the radios back. I believe it was Oxford. So message would be sent backwards and forwards for training purposes. And then when the day was done, the trucks come along and pick you up again. We took out haversack rations, consisted of a couple of sandwiches and a bottle of water.
What did you think of the sets that you were having to work?
Well, it seemed very effective, really. Yeah.
By now, did you know the name Jedburgh? Had they introduced you to that word?
No, it hadn't come about, I don't think. I can't for sure say when that was, when I first learned that we were called Jedburghs.
But did you know which part of occupied Europe you were going to go to?
No, certainly not. No, by that time we had not met the officers as such. And it was also, we were only the British element. We had no knowledge that there would be Americans involved in it. So we were just British radio operators, really.
What rank did you have by then?
Well, when we got to Milton Hall in the first instance, we were made up to what they call Lance Sergeant on a temporary basis. So that's what the rank we were given then.
Any other memories of Dunbar?
Well, it was I think we rather upset the local garrison. There used to be a barracks in Dunbar itself, and they were still in the 1914-18 war situation. All their finery there, and of course we were playing fast and loose and rather indisciplined, I suppose, and they didn't like it at all.
What form did the indiscipline take?
Well, we were just, I suppose, boisterous, really. Hollering and hooting and getting drunk, generally.
Did you do any damage?
Not that I'm aware of, no. No property damage, certainly not.
Or to individuals?
No. Well, personally, no. I can't speak for the others.
And after Dunbar?
After Dunbar, I was back to Milton Hall, where we continued with our intensive training. That was the... They taught us to do the code, encoding and decoding, more in ciphering.
How was that done?
Well, there were several systems in play. There was... But the main thing was the one-time code. I think it was called one-time code. It consisted of a book of jumbled up letters in groups of five. And you had a big, I think it was silken sheet with alphabet. I believe it's alphabet along the top and down the sides. And it was quite... arduous, really, to get it all right, because you wrote your message in the book underneath these letters, letter by letter, in groups of five, and then you would write your message, each letter, below one of these groups, and then you would, of course, carry on like that, but keep it coherent, but you just break each group of five, so it's done and broken up into groups of five. And... Is that all right with you?
Yes.
Yeah. And, of course, you do that until you completed the message. The one thing I have forgotten is that the first group would be where you changed the agreed letters in that first group. You would agree this with the organisers before you left for operations, in that you would agree that you would change first or first and last letters once, twice, whatever you liked in the alphabet. So if you change A, say three times, you go A, B, C, D. So A would then become D. Similarly with the other letter that you agreed. That was your identification code. So you had to do that every message on the first group and the last group. And also you would change the next group to identify the language that the message was in. So if it was in English, you would put five E's, or if it's in French, you put five F's, or whatever other language was being used, so that the person decoding would know what language you'd got. So there are all those bits and pieces to remember to do.
Were you given any instructions in case you were captured and played back?
Yes, yes. We were told not to reveal our identity codes, just to use the basic group, so that they would know then that, you know, you were being captured or whatever. And that was the that was the only means of identification, really, in the actual message. But they also recorded your Morse code style, your sending. Each individual is different, and so they recorded that so they could match your sending with somebody else who might take over your set.
What was your style like?
I don't know, pretty basic, I think. I think I had difficulties with V. That's three dots and a dash, you know. I sort of seemed to stumble on the dots. I don't know why. But anyway, it still came over as a V. But
that would betray that it was you doing it.
If somebody else... Oh, yes, indeed, yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's also other features of the sending that each individual had.
What else happened at the second session at Milton Hall?
Well, it was just more training, and that's right. Yeah, we went to Ringwood for actual parachute drops.
How did you get on with that?
Oh, very well, really. It's a bit frightening at first, but it's a great feeling once you've done it. I think initially we jumped out of a balloon, a static balloon at Ringwood. And then there was an aircraft drop. We dropped from an aircraft during the day. And also we did a couple of night drops. Once we got back to Milton Hall, went out to, can't recall the airfield, probably Thamesford, and where we went up to do some practice drops at night. Yeah, it was all okay, really. I can't think who it was now.
So nobody had an accident?
Yeah, I was just trying to think who it was. It's Rawlings, I think. I can't think of his first name. Yeah, I think he damaged his ankle. We didn't have anybody refuse to jump, that I recall. Everybody did it. And
after Ringwood?
Well, after Ringwood, it was back to Milton Hall for more training. And we met... Well, we were allocated to... radio operators allocated to a couple of officers. One British, one... But in my... instance, it was one British and one French. Other people had, well, usually it was an American operator who would be allocated to an American officer, and there was Belgium and Dutch. So yeah, operators were allocated to their officers.
Who was in your team?
Captain Radici, Jocelyn Radici. And Captain, well, then he was known to me as Gerville, Captain Gerville. That's Gerville. I subsequently learned that his actual name is Geminel.
What were they like? What were their backgrounds?
Well, this is difficult again, you see, because the same old thing applied. It was officers and men. Captain Radici was a gentleman. He, I believe, was an Oxford Blue of some sort or the other. I don't know quite what, but he was a gentleman and treated me very fairly. And similarly, Captain Gerville. But we were never on first name terms. And yeah, we just went out on one or two schemes together.
So this Radici was some kind of athlete, was he?
I'm not sure whether he was boxing or not. That's, you know, one of those things. We you have to be in the forces at that time to, you know, it wasn't, I could speak to these officers I'm speaking to you now. You know, it was a sort of, don't speak unless you're spoken to. Seems a strange thing, but, I mean, I found them very well, really, you know, considering the other people I've had to deal with.
Did this team that you were in have a name?
Yeah, we're called Bunny.
And did you know the word Jedbra by now?
Oh, yeah, it was Jedbra, yeah. We also had, what do you call them? Code names.
And what was yours?
Drachmar.
And the other two?
Radici was Peso, and Gerville was Yen. So that was us, that was our team, yeah.
What do you remember happening next?
Well, just continuous training, and then when was the second front was in being, and some of the teams were disappearing, and there was general euphoria, I think, in the camp. Oh, we had a great great party there on July the 14th, which is the French Bastille Day. Also happens to be my birthday. And the French embassy sent up some barrels of Algerian wine that was got through. I think it was pretty horrendous stuff, really. I think I was still drunk after 3 days, but
this is at, yeah. Milton Hall?
Yes, yeah, it was a big party there, yeah. Yeah, it was very good. And it was just a question then of course, the team started to thin out then. There was not so many left as the war progressed. And then we got our orders to report to London. I don't think where it was now. Somewhere around there where the BBC is. We were in our house there and we were briefed. And then, what happened then? Oh, then we went to a holding house somewhere in Oxford, I think it was, where we had a very good meal, and from there we went to Thamesford Airfield and got the, it was a Halifax that took us to wherever it was we went. I've forgotten now, the actual.
What was the flight like?
Very good, yeah. Uneventful.
Do you know the dates that you went across?
Yeah, this was the night of the 17th of August. I remember it well because I was married on the 10th of August, a week previously.
Which part of France did you go to?
Can you switch off a moment? It was the location in France was in the Haute-Marne, and it was near the town of Langres. I've got the actual map reference of where the drop zone was.
What was the drop like?
Well, it was very good. It was a bit frightening, really, because although I'd heard about this, I never really expected to see such, but there were three huge bonfires burning brightly, and that's where we dropped. And we landed successfully, no injuries. And the reception committee there, they all gathered in all the gear. And I was piled onto some lorries that were nearby. And we were driven through the night to the farm, a farm called La Salle. And from thence we went and made our, well, I don't know what you call it really, bivouac in the woods. Had our equipment there, the radio. And that's where we stayed. I can't recall how long it was we stayed. And then obviously a message had to be sent back to London to the effect that we had landed safely and everything was all right. So that...
Was it as you expected or were there any differences?
Well, I was totally surprised how it went, how easy it was. I expected to, have some sort of confrontation, but there certainly wasn't. It was so smooth and easy. And the people were very, very friendly.
Was this a Maquis group?
Yes, it was a Mackie group. There was a character there in charge who was called Captain Max. I can't think of his actual name, but he seems to be the one in control of the actual group.
How big was the group?
Well, it wasn't very big at that time. It was only about 30 or 40 people, but they weren't at the farm. They were still spread about. They hadn't really organised because we were still behind the lines. The Allies were advancing from the south and the west. So, it's still happy days, trying to get things organised.
What impression did the members of the Maquis group make on you?
I think they were totally surprised that we were there in uniform and the ability to get them supplies, that they needed. And, of course, it was the Captain Radici and Gerville's job to sort out various targets to be attacked or sabotaged as such, and the equipment needed to do it.
What kind of targets did they have?
I think they were looking for railway lines and petrol depots.